let's move on to another song here, and let me set this up. And this is Love Me Do. So we'll talk about Andy's contribution here. A number of you will know some of the history of this is that the Beatles come into the recording studio in June of 1962 with their first drummer, Pete Best, and record a demo of the song Love Me Do. The George Martin and I guess Ron Richards here think, well, this is, you know, not very good, but maybe we can do something with this. We'll bring in a session drummer. Meantime, the Beatles and Brian Epstein go out, get rid of Pete Best, bring in Ringo Starr. Right. So they bring Ringo Starr into the studio in September, early September, and do a version of Love Me Do. They're still not happy. So they call out to Mr. Dependable, Andy White, to come in and do this. And if you're trying to listen to the difference, you hear different versions of Love Me Do. The version with Ringo is out there. In fact, it was the single in the UK, but it's the LP, and over here is all Andy's versions out there. You can always tell the version with Andy because Ringo's playing tambourine on here. So hear the tambourine part. But something I'd never listened for, and Andy told me last night, he said, I didn't play any hi-hat on it. I can't do the accent. He says, I didn't play any hi-hat.
I don't know why that was. No, I don't really know why it was, but we didn't use a hi-hat. Maybe because they knew they were going to put Ringo and tambourine. Give them space to play it.
But you also said that one of the things you were doing was linking up what you were doing with the bass drum with what Paul was doing on the bass.
Yeah, yeah.
And indeed, that's one of the things that distinguishes that version of Love Me Do from the other two.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So Jesse, can we hear that now?
Yeah.
So, Sam, do you remember anything of this session?
Oh, yeah.
What do you remember?
I remember Ringo coming in and seeing me setting up the drums, you know. The look of his face would have killed him, you know, like that. And he's never forgotten it, even to this day.
Have you talked to him since then? Something. Have you talked to him since then?
I never talked to him at all, ever.
He wouldn't understand you anyway.
No, he wouldn't. I was involved with John and Paul that whole session because they had done the music and they used those routines, of course. So I had to learn the routines, and the time was all taken up with that. And I didn't speak to George or Paul or Ringo, not because I didn't want to, but just too busy. You know? And we also did a take of Please Please Me, which went on the first album, you know, in my version.
Your version?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I liked that one because that was a good arrangement, a lot of good breaks and things in it, you know? Very good. And I know exactly that it said, obviously I can tell the sound of my drums, you know, anywhere.
Right. You were playing Ludwig's,
yeah.
Right? And Ringo still had his old premieres, I think.
Oh, yeah. Bunch of old rubbish, yeah. the drum sound in the giveaway. But somebody in EMI, you know, said, no, well, they didn't say it to me, but they said, no, Ringo did that, you know. Please, please me. I don't know, it wasn't them. I said, put the sound of the drums up, you know. So,
yeah, they get to... get out of touch with realities in these people, and they believe what they want to believe, and it suits them to believe that we didn't. It sounds a little bit strange for us to say this, but it's a good opportunity to know skin off my nose or Andy's, whatever we say, but I'm just telling you the truth that they didn't want to admit that guys were helping the groups out at that particular time. And it actually happens today as well, you know, but much more. In fact, just a story to go on. The Beatles used to record in EMI 2, which is like Decca, they had three studios. EMI 2, EMI 1 was big, enormous. It was so big that they had they recorded the Scots Guards in this studio, and they wanted to record them in stereo, going backwards and forwards. So that I remember turning up there one day, and there was all these guys all dressed in their uniforms, and Busby's and Crosby's, what else. with their socks on, but just their socks on, walking, marching up and down the studio so they could get the effect of this band going backwards and forwards. But anyway, the Beatles used to do recording EMI-2, but when they were there, we used to do EMI-3. And we used to go into the control room of 2 and look down. And when they were there, they were laying about, sleeping in sleeping bags and stuff. They used to take like one day to do a title and sometimes, because they didn't. They went in there because they were contracted to do it, and they didn't know what they were going to do until they went in. So they were just like Ringo would be sleeping on a couch or something they had there, and George and Paul would be working a tune out or something, and it'd take them all day to get one title, even the ideas of one title. So, but you can't argue with their wonderful abilities, you know, which came out with this sort of youthful, wonderful energy that captured the world. So, you know, who's to say what's right and what's wrong?
Okay, just ask a question about equipment. We'll probably come back to the equipment question. You had Ludwigs, but Ludwigs weren't always easy to get in the UK in the early 60s, were they?
No, and the funny thing was, I told you I did that rock and roll tour and the States with Dick Lewis's band, which was a 15-piece dance band, a tour with for about 6 years, I think, when the Roads of England. And it's a wonder I'm still here. It's like, not with all the greasy spoon food and everything else. But anyway, what happens was they had an exchange system. For instance, if an American band came over to England, like the Count Basie band, then they had an agreement between the two unions that an English band had to go to America for the same amount of time. So this happened with Big Lewis. And we were in the States for 3 weeks, which was wonderful for us, you know, because we had a lot of good music. The only thing was they put us in a rock and roll show. And we were supposed to be a big band, kind of jazz band, you know. So, and we played a lot of Stan Kenton music at the time as well. So what we were doing like intermission riff, a Kenton number, but with a rock and roll rhythm, you know.
Yeah.
The heavy backbeat is a rock and roll rhythm.
Yeah.
However, we only played 3 numbers on this show, like a 10-minute spot. And one of them was backing a saxophonist, Tommy Whittle, very, very good player, tenor player. But there was only really 2 band members. However, the rest of the show was wonderful because the top of the bill was Bill Haley and the Comets. And they had, what was he doing? Chuck Berry was the opening act, if you can believe it. And they had a big black band that backed all the acts, who were mostly colored guys, you know, in the acts anyway. But it was really raw rock and roll. It was just an incredible experience. The loudest drummer in the world called him Foots because he played the bass drum. Yeah, and the funny thing was that Foots had been in the band 15 years. And Span, who was a bass player, he'd been in the band 11 years, and he still complained about the bass drum. There hasn't been any difference. You still get your side and say, you're crazy, man.
Was that job satisfaction or what?
Yeah, job satisfaction. Yeah.
So did you pick up your Ludwig kit when you were doing that tour?
Yes. Well, that was just the story I was trying to get to. When we knew we were going to the States, you know, you couldn't get good instruments in Britain at that time. And guys used to get them brought over on the ships, you know, the Queen Mary, the Elizabeth, all of them. If you knew somebody on the ship's band, you know,
bring
cymbals and snare drum and bits and pieces. But this was a big chance. So the guys all took old instruments in old cases. And as soon as they got there, they were down to Manny's, you know, on West 48th Street, new instruments in old cases.
Yeah.
We did the tour, and I didn't even pick my drums up till after the tour, because I used this guy's drum. Anyway, when we were going back, The band manager came back on his own with the instruments, big pile of instruments, old cases. And he got off the plane in New York there. And he had all the cases ready for the band bus, which hadn't arrived. You know, and the customs guy said, "Well, we'll have to have a look at that." And he had a big clipboard. And this guy is sweating blood, you know, the manager. He's so he's trying to talk his way out of it, you know. And all of a sudden, the bus appeared. He said to the guy, "Well, I'm sorry," he said, "but the bus has just arrived." And he said, "Oh, well, go ahead."
Load them on.
Perhaps I should point out for some of the folks here that the Ludwigs are American-made drums.
Yes.
They're not available in Britain very easily.
They were great drums. Yeah. It so happened that Ringo started playing the same set.
Same drum.
Yeah. Although I think the quality of Ludwig went down because they had such a run on that drum set that he didn't take the same time, you know, to finish them off with the other ones.
In other words, as soon as Ringo was seen on television playing with the Ludwigs,
exactly,
they started cranking him out of the back.
Yeah.
Strange. Nick, you had also some experiences with equipment too.
Yeah, well, because I've got a Fender 62 Strat and a Fender 64, and in fact they gave me, I had a 60, I think it was 60 and a half Strat, 61, and I was coming out from a gig that we were doing, and I was loading the car up, and these guys came, and they were gonna actually start beating me up or something, which is a risk when you finish late. And I put the guitar down the side of this is a 61 Strat, I put the guitar down the side, and I had to pay £160 for it, I always remember that, the side of the car, and these guys started coming up and like pushing me and stuff. So I said, "Just a minute." So I got in the car as if I was going to go, and I was like, "Oh, it's gone." And of course the next morning, I had to go and do a date, and I opened the guitar, I said, "Shit." And I remember leaving it because it had gone. And I'd insured it, so I went down to this place in the Charing Cross Road and got the only other Strat that was in England, which a guy had just taken the delivery of, you know. Thanks, Joe, just like this one. And so I got the money for the insurance, and I got another Strat for nothing, really. And that was a bit of a smell, still got that 62 Strat. But a sorry story of that, and this is the sort of thing that you had to do when I was doing this TV show, which is a big TV show in the UK. I've been working with the Stratocaster, and there'd be a few chips and bits and things, and this producer came up, the director came up and said, "Vic," he said, "we're doing some close-ups of you doing these solos." He said, "So we can't have that crappy-looking guitar on this bloody television, so can you do something with it?" So I took it home, and I sanded it down. And painted it with a car spray white, you know. So that kind of took about $10,000 off it. But you have to learn to live with that sort of thing. And then, and he didn't even say thank you either. And I used to Fender, and I've got a Martin D28 and an Epiphone 12 string, a Gibson L7C, and all the stuff that I haven't played. I don't play too much right now, but.
So what kinds of things would you carry around in the boot of your car?
The
trunk,
yeah.
Of your car.
I had a Fender Vibralux amplifier, always a Fender Strat. The one time I had a Gibson Les Paul. And you'd get the car with the biggest boot, the biggest trunk, so you could cram all this stuff in. I had this banjo, a Martin ukulele, and the 12-string. Because basically you wanted electric, acoustic, and 12-string, and the banjo and the ukulele and everything else was extra. So you had to be ready. The guy said, "Oh, I really want this guitar. I had to have it in the trunk to go and get it." So you're pulling your arms out like a bit stuff about. So it's weird. And he's coming with your fingers like this. The guy said, "Yeah, 2, 3, 4. I said, "Oh, my God." Not quite as bad as that.